This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, everyone. This is Steve Phelan with a continuation of a story on the archives of American Heritage Magazine. This week, we're going on with a story called Shinn, S-H-I-N-N. He was the most naturally gifted of the eight, a group of artists, and his vigorous, uninhibited vision of city light transformed American painting at the turn of the century. In fact, he may have been too gifted. The next fall, Shinn enrolled at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. Then, fearful that his father might cut off his allowance on learning he had not gone to Swarthmore College as planned, he found his way to the office of the Philadelphia Press and landed a job as an artist reporter, reporting fires, strikes, train wrecks, highway accidents, elections, murders, suicides, and other events in pen and ink sketches. Here was work for a very junior draftsman that was anything but boring. Shinn, not yet 17, quickly taught himself to fix in his mind the details of a newsworthy spectacle while jotting down pertinent information on handy scraps of paper. He then dashed back to the office to reproduce the scene faithfully in swift pen strokes for the waiting photo engraver. Because he attended the Pennsylvania Academy by day, Shinn worked on the newspaper's graveyard shift. At first, he lived alone in a furnished room. Early in 1894, however, 26-year-old George B. Lux, L-U-K-S, back in America after a decade of study and travel in Europe, joined the press's art staff, and the two moved into a small apartment on Girard Avenue. At just under 5.5 feet, Lux was about Shinn's height, but a lot stockier. Lux was a regular at O'Malley's across the street from the press building, where, in Shinn's words, quote, his rumbling advance along a bar rail was like a tank rolling on with a child at the wheel and all guns popping cork. For his part, the hard-drinking Lux deplored his roommate's abstinence. Shinn, he would tell him, you got a hell of a lot of promise, but you'll never make the grade. And why won't you? You won't drink. That's sad. Liquor does it. Liquor and nothing else. But Shinn soon did make the grade, to the extent of being hired away from the press by the Philadelphia Inquirer. There he met the staff artist, John Sloan, 5 years his senior, who was sharing a studio with Robert Henri, and before long, he and Lux were, at Sloan's invitation, repairing on Tuesday evenings to 806 Walnut Street for earnest discussions, centered on music or literature as often as on art, and with other young men, artists, and art students. Henri, at 29, the group's mentor, revered the great realist painter Thomas Eakins, who had taught at the academy until he was dismissed for insisting on using nude male models in his life classes, and who sought, as he said, to, quote, peer deeper into the heart of American life. Henri used the weekly discussions to expound his own similar vision of art as a medium for expressing life and especially humanity. All this was too much for Lux, who soon stopped coming, and pretty much over the head of the 18-year-old Shinn, preoccupied with dating girls and adding to his flashy wardrobe. But the youth did enjoy the company of his fellow artist reporters, one of whom, quiet William J. Glackens of the Philadelphia Ledger, aged 24, was to become his closest friend among the eight. Over the next year, Shinn and Lux bounced around among the Press, Inquirer, and Evening Bulletin, while Sloan, lacking the speed of execution needed to cover spot news, stayed with the Inquirer, working mostly on its Sunday supplement. Henri taught at Philadelphia's School of Design for Women until May of 1895, when he and Glackens went to Europe to sketch, paint, and look around. In January 1896, the Evening Bulletin sent Shinn's former roommate, Lux, to Cuba to cover an insurrection, but then fired him for not filing his work on time. After sailing to New York City, Lux got a job on Joseph Pulitzer's New York World, turning out America's first regular comic panel, the Yellow Kid in place of its creator, Richard Auchult, who by then was producing his own Yellow Kid for William Randolph Hearst's New York Journal. Hearst's raids on the World's art staff created vacancies, and when Glackens came home from Europe jobless, Lux found him work drawing cartoons. Then he talked his boss into luring Shin to the World with a $3 a week raise. Thus, by the winter of 1897-98, three-quarters of the quartet known to art history as the Philadelphia Four had moved permanently to New York. The fourth, Sloan, was not to join them until 1904. Meanwhile, Shin's good friend Glackens, tired of cartooning, had resumed his old occupation at the New York Herald. And when, in April 1898, the United States went to war with Spain, in part as a consequence of strident warmongering by the Journal and the World, McClure's sent him to Cuba to cover the fighting there, a job he ably did until the August armistice. And Shin, having late in 1897 turned 21 and begun to earn the same number of dollars weekly, he set out to woo Florence Scoville, a Pennsylvania Academy student and budding illustrator. Pretty, witty, and talented, Flossie Scoville was related to Boston's Biddle family, and Shin had to submit to being scrutinized by representatives of that exalted clan. His occupation can hardly have commended him to them, and his natty appearance, like a jockey dressed to go out on the town, someone said, was not calculated to win their confidence either. But whatever they thought of him, he and Flossie were married on June 26, 1898. By then, Henri, too, was married. He was living and painting in Paris, but such was his influence, even in absentia, that both Sloan and Glackens were busily working away in oils in their spare time. Glackens, now sharing an apartment with Lux, persuaded the latter to take up brushes, too, while Shin began on his own to experiment with pastel chalks. If Henri had turned the first two draftsmen into painters, (quote), he could make anyone want to be an artist, Sloan was to say. New York itself helped do the same to the others. Aware that advances in photographic reproduction would soon eliminate his job, Shin resolved to get into the better paid and more prestigious field of magazine illustration. One showcase that illustrators particularly prized was the center spread of Harper's Weekly, the preserve of Charles Dana Gibson and Edwin Austin Abbey, and late in 1898, Shin made up his mind to crash it. He began turning up at the magazine's office on Fridays, but by his own account, he never even got so far as untying the strings of his ever-thicker portfolio. After a year of this, he despaired of selling his wares, and instead simply left them at Harper's with an explanatory note. On returning the following week, he was shown into the presence of Colonel George Harvey, the editor and publisher, who was leafing through his sketches and finished pastels. Quote, "You have here," Harvey began, "such a variety of New York street scenes. Had Shin, by chance, a large color drawing of the Metropolitan Opera House in a snowstorm?" Shin pretended to consider the matter. "I think I have," he said. "Good," said Harvey. "Have it here at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning." The artist labored over the picture all night to give it the requisite look of having been effortlessly dashed off, and arrived at Colonel Harvey's office lightheaded. The editor studied the pastel. "We have to decide on a price," he said at last. "How about $400, and you own the original?" When the issue of Harper's Weekly containing his center spread came out in mid-February 1900, Shin could feel he had arrived on the national scene. And later that month, the Boussade Valadon Galleries launched a one-man show of his pastels to notices that were nearly all favorable. During his year-long siege of Harper's Weekly, Shin had done portraits of the actresses Julia Marlowe and Elsie DeWolf, and the prolific playwright Clyde Fitch. DeWolf, then about to become a decorator, had introduced Shin to Stanford White, who liked his pastels well enough to arrange his first big exhibition at Boussade. I'm sorry, Busad Baladin. It's odd. That's the double name, I guess. Thanks to this timely boost by the era's most celebrated architect and the town's preeminent tastemaker, Shin's work would be displayed during the opening years of the century in the very plushest of New York's plush grottos, again at Busad Baladin. Parentheses, J.P. Morgan bought 2 pictures, then at Krauschar's, Knoedler's, Durer-Ruhl, and E. Gimpel and Wildenstein, which I guess are all art studio or art stores. Shin found himself before long turning out murals, screens, and ornamental panels for houses and apartments that DeWolf decorated, and for urban and rural mansions that White designed and built. On jobs of this kind, he sought inspiration in the art of the 18th century court painters, Watteau, Boucher, and Fragonard, producing nymphs and satyrs, cupids and lovers, shepherds and shepherdesses, imbued with a delicacy and airy grace no other member of the 8 could have equaled. He employed this Rococo revival style as well to decorate the ceilings of a new house and 2 ornate pianos of Clyde Fitch's. The grateful playwright, chronically short of cash, paid him with a pair of gold chairs and a mahogany table. It was through Fitch that Shin met the impresario David Belasco. Sometime after Stanford White's fatal shooting by Harry Thaw in 1906, Belasco commissioned Shin to paint 18 large murals for a new Broadway theater, the Stuyvesant. Stage-struck though he was all his life, the artist remained unimpressed by this dominant figure on the theatrical scene, who he considered a, quote, colossal faker. Nor did he fall for his flattery. Quote, Belasco knew, he explained long afterward, that Stanford White had been my friend, and that by my proximity to his unerring taste, I must have gained something of selectivity. It assured him of guidance toward those objects that would advertise still further his reputation for impeccable taste. With money flowing in from his magazine work and private commissions, Shin had bought a brick house at 112 Waverly Place, a few doors west of Washington Square. In the entrance hall of which Clyde Fitch's table and chairs now occupied an honored place. From New York, on February 16, 1904, he and Flossie entrained to Hartford, Connecticut, for the wedding of Bill Glackens at 34, the last bachelor holdout of the old Philadelphia gang, and Edith Dimmock, an art student. When, after a honeymoon trip, the newlyweds returned to New York, they settled temporarily in a one-room studio in an uptown building where Henri, then abroad, had a studio. A few weeks later, Sloan, having at last quit Philadelphia, moved into Henri's place with his Dolly. And that summer, to Shin's delight, the Glackensons found a studio apartment almost next door to him at 3 Washington Square. Flossie and Edith, neighbors now, took to each other at once and in no time were intimates. By then, the erstwhile Philadelphia newspaper artists had formed the habit of dining with their wives and New York friends at a 6th Avenue restaurant called Mouquin's, the setting of which may be Glackens' best-known picture, Chez Mouquin from 1905. But since Shin was a teetotaler, he didn't really enjoy these convivial evenings and attended only occasionally. Glackens was his main link with the others, and it was through him that he soon met Ernest Lawson, a mild, smiling painter of landscapes who, with his wife, occupied a studio around the corner from them both in McDougal Alley. Shin already knew 2 other unconventional painters whose work Henri admired and with whom he himself would soon be associated. The shy bachelor Maurice Prendergast of Boston, whose joyously polychrome, tapestry-like watercolors of women and children at the seaside and in city parks could lift the heaviest hearts, and Arthur B. Davies, who lived upstairs from the Macbeth Galleries and had arranged Henri's first one-man show there in 1902. In the summer of 1906, as in summers past and to come, the Shins and the Glackenses rented cottages on Great South Bay in Bellport, Long Island. That fall and winter, Shin was so busy decorating fashionable houses in Connecticut and working up murals for Belasco's theater that he gave little thought to the fate of the pictures he had routinely submitted to the National Academy of Design for possible exhibition. Not so Henri, now both an academician and a member of the selection jury. To his dismay, his fellow jurors, in considering paintings for the winter exhibition, turned down all of those by Shin, Lux, and Glackens. And for the spring show, they rejected, over his vociferous protests, every single picture submitted by Shin, Lux, Glackens, Lawson, and Davies. This was too much for Henri. Irate, he withdrew two of the three paintings of his own that had been approved for exhibition, and soon began, with Sloan, Glackens, and others, to look into the possibility of mounting an independent show. Before long, Davies informed Sloan that the Macbeth galleries could be theirs for 2 weeks the following winter, and since William Macbeth had long supported the more individual American painters, everyone found this solution appropriate. Asked by letter whether he wanted to take part, Prendergast replied from Boston that he was, quote, for it strong. And in mid-May, with the roster of participants complete, the story was given to the newspapers, which promptly took sides for and against the eight, quote, apostles of ugliness, 9 months in advance of their scheduled act of rebellion. Of the eight pastels and oils that Shin contributed to the epical show of February 1908, six, including the London Hippodrome, were explicitly theatrical. Glimpses of ballet dancers, an acrobat, musicians in an orchestra, but the one that was sold, Girl in Blue, was not. The purchaser was Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney, the socialite sculptor and future founder of the Whitney Museum of American Art, who also bought three other pictures out of the show. A month later, she was to acquire from Shin four red chalk drawings and a monotype. So even as it enabled him to combat the tyranny of academic taste, the exhibition brought him a tidy profit. In April 1910, Shin, along with every other member of the eight except Lux, whose long overdue first one-man show conflicted with it, took part in a huge, successful 600-work exhibition of the independent artists, open to all comers. The following year, Shin was commissioned to execute for the Trenton, New Jersey City Hall two very large murals representing the city's main industrial sites, a steel mill and a pottery works. He put in 6 months familiarizing himself with the workmen and their operations at the two plants before going to work on the huge panels. The Rococo Revival style he ordinarily employed for murals would obviously have been inappropriate for the subjects in question, and his muscular, half-naked male figures toiling in the blazing light and heat of the steel furnace and kilns are relentlessly realistic. Around this time, Shin, on impulse, built in the court behind 112 Waverly Place a complete little theater containing seats for 55 spectators. He wrote burlesque melodramas, among them Hazel Weston, or, and you've probably heard of this, More Sinned Against Than Usual, in which Flossie Shin played the title role of the village schoolmarm, who, as an innocent victim of scandal, is driven out into a snowstorm by the farm couple, played by Shin and Edith Glackens, with whom she lodged. Hazel is then pursued by the villainous Fludgeon Smith, played by Glackens, who, failing to possess her by foul means, offers matrimony. At this point in the story, Shin's muse abruptly abandoned him, and at a rehearsal, he invited Flossie to come up with her own retort. Glaring defiance at her loathed suitor, she instantly cried, "You vampire in viper's form! Rather 1,000 times would I be dead, with a snowdrift in my hair. That, sir, would be my bridal wreath." On opening night, this speech elicited a tumult of cheering and clapping. The subsequent history of Shin's melodramas must have astonished him. Approached one day by a showman, their author gladly sold him the rights to them for a small sum, perhaps a couple of $100s, whereupon they became staple offerings on the vaudeville circuit, bringing their new owner revenue year after year. Hazel Weston was translated into 6 languages, including those of Scandinavia, and continued to be performed for nearly a quarter of a century. Often, it is said, in rural parts of Europe, where credulous peasants took it quite seriously. But things were not going so smoothly in the Shin's life as these pleasant theatrical diversions would suggest. As the artist's biographer, Edith DeShazo, disclosed in her 1974 book, Everett Shin, A Figure in His Time, Florence Shin dreaded becoming pregnant, and for this reason often shrank from lovemaking, wherefore Shin sought and found solace discreetly with other women. All the same, he remained devoted to her, and the pair, outstandingly attractive, charming, and thoroughly compatible in many ways, presented to the world a picture of connubial felicity. Then, one day, early in 1912, Shin told his wife he wanted a divorce. When she had recovered from the blow sufficiently to act, she applied for the decree, citing misconduct on Shin's part with 3 women in the course of a month, and in August, her petition was granted. As Shin must have foreseen would happen, the Glackenses took a dim view of his casting aside his wife, a great favorite of theirs, and their relations with him cooled. In retrospect, these ruptures, with his wife and with the fellow artists he esteemed above all others, could be seen as symptoms of a profound change in the man himself. For the year 1912 marks a clear break between the brilliant opening phase of his career and another longer but far less distinguished one. The curious fact is that by 35, an age at which many an artist just begins to hit his stride, Shin had peaked, and his best work was behind him. He continued to paint easel pictures, but he stopped courting kudos as a painter to concentrate on commercial success. Whereas he had exhibited work at an average of 3 shows a year since 1899, he was not to do so again until 1920, and after that, not until 1937. Asked late in 1912 to exhibit at the Armory Show, being organized under the leadership of Arthur Davies, Shin either declined or simply ignored the invitation. That enormously significant exhibition, which exposed stay-at-home Americans for the first time to works by the post-impressionist masters Cézanne, Van Gogh, and Gauguin, to Cubism and Fauvism, and to Marcel Duchamp's Nude Descending a Staircase, opened in New York's 69th Regiment Armory in February of 1913. But it is unlikely that Shin, hostile to all modern art of whatever provenance, even bothered to attend it. In March of 1913, Shin married Corinne Baldwin, a young woman from upstate New York who he had met in Belport. His new wife was to bear him 2 children, Janet and David, in 1915 and 1916, respectively. The couple eventually settled near the village of Palinville, at the foot of the Catskill Mountains, where Shin built a vast and imposing fieldstone house that he christened Bellewick. In 1915, an intriguing commentary on Shin appeared in print in a faintly ludicrous novel by Theodore Dreiser. The genius, whose tirelessly womanizing artist hero, Eugene Witla, was popularly supposed to have been based on Shin, just as a number of Witla's pictures were, from the author's descriptions of them, unmistakably based on Sloane's. Dreiser had met several of the ashcan painters while editing magazines to which they contributed illustrations, but he knew none of them well. Nor, it was clear, did he have a clue about the economics of selling and buying modern American paintings. Both Sloane and Shin made the point to reporters that Witla, who easily sells his pictures of slum life for $18,000 apiece, could not possibly exist in the real world. 2 years later, Goldwyn Pictures, still located in New York, signed up Shin, at 40, too old to serve in World War I, as art director. His employers put him to work designing sets for a feature entitled Polly of the Circus. The movie did well at the box office, and in 1920, Inspiration Pictures offered Shin a contract as art director on a film based on a Joseph Hergesheimer novel entitled The Bright Shawl, about a Cuban rebellion in 1870, with a cast that included Richard Barthelemous, Dorothy Gish, and Mary Astor. Shin accepted. The Bright Shawl was a big success, and it caught the eye of William Randolph Hearst, who so admired the film's authentic-looking tropical backgrounds that in 1923 he hired Shin for his Cosmopolitan Pictures at a gratifyingly large salary to create sets and costumes for a Revolutionary War saga called Janus Meredith. Hearst told Shin he was spending $1 million on the project. When the film was well into production, its art director finally realized that this unheard-of sum was being lavished almost entirely on making a showcase for its star, the producer's mistress, Marion Davies, with little regard for historical accuracy or artistic integrity. And, in a fine and rare gesture of moral indignation, he resigned, never again to work in motion pictures. In the meantime, Shin and his second wife had been divorced. Their central problem arose, it seems, from the fact that while Everett was fastidious to a fault, Corinne was just the opposite. An excellent mother, she was a decidedly indifferent housekeeper, and this drove Shin, who greatly valued comfort and order, to distraction. In March 1924, he married an actress named Gertrude Chase, and the pair settled into a big frame house in Westport, Connecticut. That year, and throughout the boom years ahead, Shin was chiefly occupied with decorating private houses in New York City and especially its affluent suburbs and exurbs, in the Rococo Revival style at which he was so adept. Until the Great Depression cut them off, these commissions earned him a more than decent living. One consequence of Shin's third marriage that pleased him greatly was the resumption of his friendship with the Glackenses, for Edith, who had taken a dislike to Corinne, warmed to Gertrude. From Shin's point of view, however, his third wife had a serious shortcoming in her fondness for parties, which in those Prohibition days almost invariably involved the consumption of bootleg liquor. He not only, as an abstainer, disapproved of alcohol in principle, but also felt strongly that many people, including many of their neighbors, were a waste of his time. The couple's disagreements on this score gave rise to bitter quarrels, and then to separations, during which both, it seems, were unfaithful. Finally, in March of 1932, Gertrude Shin was granted a divorce on the grounds of cruelty, Shin allegedly having caused her extreme mental anguish by photographing her, on dozens of occasions, in the nude. Well, after that very lurid revelation, we will take a break and come back with the rest of this article next week and probably have time to start something new in addition. But for the moment, this is Steve Phelan saying goodbye for American Heritage Archives.